Welcome to a Juno Afternoon on Monday, May 23rd, 2016. I'm your host, Scott Burton. On today's show, Jeff Kirsch, Elise Soren-Burke, and Paige will be here to highlight Montessori choices this summer. Patricia Kalbrenner will introduce us to the Juno Film Office. Andrew Heist will tell us about a special opportunity to get a sneak peek at the Alaska State Museum. And Kim Hecox will be on the show to talk about current projects. Those interviews, National Native News, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more right here on a Juno afternoon, currently 57 degrees here in the capital city.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Some tribal leaders in New Mexico say their top concern this presidential election is sovereignty, and they're looking to the candidates for their knowledge of Indian country and promises to ensure tribal rights. A handful of tribal leaders and representatives met with U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders Friday in Santa Fe at one of the presidential hopefuls' campaign stops.
I think the most important thing for any president to understand is that tribal sovereignty.
Robert Medina is a councilman from Zia Pueblo.
Tribes are still here. We were here first. We need assistance, though. Funding, a lot of times what's been happening a lot lately is funding's being cut, and it impacts everyone on the reservation. Infrastructure, housing, health care, law enforcement, courts, social services. I mean, the list goes on and on. I think just recognizing the tribes do have their own sovereignty, but at the same time, we do need assistance, and the funding that we get is minimal. We still need it.
Medina's views were echoed by others who attended the meeting, including Governor of Santo Domingo Pueblo, Daniel Corrice. Corrice says he would like to see better communication with government officials and wants to see the annual White House Tribal Summit continue, which President Obama has hosted the last 7 years.
So we need to continue, and we need to have this in place. This is my major concern of how our candidate here, Mr. Sanders, how he will address this is everything. Sovereignty is everything for us.
Sanders, when asked about sovereignty and his commitment to tribes as president or senator well after the election is over, says there needs to be a new relationship developed between tribes and the government.
The conditions that I have seen in Pine Ridge and on other reservations are absolutely unacceptable. And that means significant improvements over the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Indian Health Service, and in other areas.
After meeting with tribal leaders, Sanders spoke to a crowd of more than 2,000 people inside Santa Fe Community College, where he touched on a number of issues like poverty and justice reform, calling for improved education and jobs to help end large incarceration rates of Latino, African American, and Native American people. This campaign season has also included calls from groups and individuals for clemency for long-imprisoned Native activist Leonard Peltier, which Sanders says is an issue he'd look into.
It's something I want to look at. I am not unsympathetic to that, but I want to take another look at it.
At rallies in Santa Fe and Albuquerque, Sanders mentioned Native Americans in his speech, saying they've been lied to, cheated to, and treaties have been broken, adding that much debt is owed to Native Americans and little has been paid. Alaska Native hospital patients can now enjoy some traditional foods. KMBA's Jocelyn Estes has more.
In Sitka, subsistence fishermen place hemlock trees in the water and herring lay clumps of eggs on the branches. Some of the branches are flown to Anchorage, where at least one Alaska Native Medical Center patient waits with anticipation.
I gotta have some of that.
78-year-old Mamie Alexander says if she were home in Ketchikan, she'd be eating fish eggs by the plateful. For now, she's happy to have some in a green salad.
Is it good? No time to talk.
Dr. Gary Ferguson says a change in federal law allows health care providers to serve donations of traditional foods.
Our goal is to have traditional foods here at the hospital, a regular thing on the menu, and the new menu has herring eggs, so you can order herring eggs right here at the hospital.
The Alaska Native Medical Center menu also includes dishes such as pierogi or fish pie, beach asparagus, and fiddlehead ferns. Ferguson says traditional foods offer patients rich nutritional benefits as well as a taste from home. I'm Jocelyn Estes.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
If you or a loved one suffer from alcohol addiction, hear how recovery is possible from those who have their day one at nativenews.net. The Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce's Convention and Tourism Department welcomes the Navajo Nation Bar Association to the Albuquerque Sheraton Uptown June 9th and 10th. Information on convention and tourism services at siabq.org. That's siabq.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, May 23rd, 2016. Scott Burton, your host. It's about 6 minutes after the hour, and in the studio now with me are Jeff Kirsch, Paige, and Elise Sorenberg, and we're here to talk about some Montessori opportunities this summer. Welcome to the show, you three. It's nice to have you here.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. You want to start, Jeff? Jeff, you're the president of the board of Juno Montessori. Tell us a little bit about your school over there.
So we are the that schoolhouse-looking building that's right there by Sandy Beach and the all the softball fields over there by Sabico. That's Juno Montessori School. And we have a toddler program that is for – this is a year-round toddler program. And then we have two primary classrooms, which are, you know, three through kindergarten. But this is the first time that we're offering – a special summer program, and we're calling it KIND, which stands for K, kids, I, N, N, nature, and then D, Douglas. And that's a little bit wacky, but we like KIND better than kin. But it's basically a summer camp. It runs from July 6th to July 25th. There's four separate two-week sessions, and it's focusing it's for children who are kind of graduating from kindergarten, going into first grade in the fall. There are not a lot of options for them here in town, so we thought we would start something up like that. Of course, also the program would be open to, I mean, ages 4 through 7, but really we wanted to have something for our graduating kindergartners to do, and then all of the graduating kindergartners in town, as well as students who may be starting kindergarten in the fall, whether that be at our school or in the public school or, you know, wherever the charter school, wherever they happen to be going.
Okay. Elise, will you tell us what you teach at the school? And then I understand you've been helping with the curriculum for the summer program. Tell us about that, too.
Sure. I'm one of the primary guides at the school. I teach in the downstairs classroom. It's a mixed-age class with ages 3 to 6. And this summer program idea has kind of come about just because of the school's location. It's really an ideal location for this kind of outdoor education, exploration type activity. And the sessions are the beach, the forest, the alpine, and the town. So the idea of each two-week session is really to delve into that specific ecosystem or space and learn all you can about it through actively engaging with the environment. In Montessori, we really believe that children learn from the environment.
And I understand. Did you say you're a guide and you identify as a guide rather than a teacher?
Yeah, in Montessori, most teachers tend to call themselves a guide or a directress or something along those lines.
Directress, I never heard of that before. Guide, definitely.
Guide is a really, because the idea is that you aren't necessarily the source of the knowledge, you're just the person who helps connect the child to the environment.
Right, guiding the child. So the Montessori environment, if you're in the classroom, has a lot of different types of work, which are basically activities, and they're the same in every Montessori program across the world, basically. But, you know, again, this program kind of is more, adapting that Montessori philosophy, but kind of taking it into the outdoors. And so it's going to be fun, and it's going to be outdoors. It's kind of sort of like what, Discovery Southeast would be doing, but of course they, it's second grade and up for them only. I mean, this is more of a geared for younger children, and they'll be, you know, make use of the shelters. And there used to be summer program that used to happen down at Sandy Beach that stopped, and we thought to ourselves, like, we've just got all this great space down here. I mean, Douglas is an incredible place. You can go in the forest, you can go on the beach, you can go in the forest and the beach in the same day, you know, within half an hour. I mean, we just did that on Saturday, so.
Yeah. So, Paige, you are now in third grade, is that right?
Second, but I'm going into third grade.
Okay. At which school?
Gastineau.
Okay, but you went to the Montessori, is that right?
Yeah.
Thinking back on your time at the Montessori, what was some of your favorite things about that school?
I wrote a play, and, yeah.
Do you remember where that play got performed, Paige?
It got performed on a shelter near Sandy Beach.
Yeah, in that play, in that amphitheater.
Very cool. Yeah. What was it about?
It was about a butterfly and her friends.
And the butterfly got captured
and then very dramatic.
Released.
Yeah. It was very dramatic. It was wonderful. And the children did all their own costumes. It was amazing.
I don't think I wrote a play when I was in kindergarten. That's very cool.
Yeah, Paige likes writing plays. And she wrote, you guys wrote a lot of poems that year, too. Mm-hmm. But it's very much, you know, so Montessori is very it's very child-directed. And so, you know, if Paige was like, I'd like to write a play, then the guide, instead of saying, well, that's not something that we're doing right now, we're doing painting now, is like, okay, I will help you do this. And you guys wound up making sets and costumes. It was extremely adorable. and it actually was nice and sunny that day, too, that they actually did the performance. It was really, I remember this was a few years ago, and it's, like, still stuck in my mind. Yeah, you may or may not necessarily have your kid writing a play, and I don't want everyone to, no play guaranteed coming out of this program, but they will do a bunch of play and a bunch of work, and, you know, and the great thing about this, too, is that we've got flexibility in times, too. You can go from 8:30 to 3:30. You can go 8:30 a.m. to 5:30 as a full day, and you can also go 12:30 p.m. to 5:30 p.m., so if, you know, if your child is in the fine arts camp, which is another great program in this town, so many great summer programs, you at that age you can only go until noon. So if you're looking for something else for your child to do, you know, this would be a really great option for you.
Elise, tell us about what one of these sessions may look like.
Sure. So they're 2-week sessions, and basically, the idea is to have the morning kind of in the Montessori environment, but it's a combined indoor-outdoor environment. And so you have the very typical, almost necessary for it to be called Montessori, 3-hour work cycle, where it's 3 hours of children engaging with materials in an uninterrupted setting. What's unique is that we get to incorporate the garden environment, and then we'll also incorporate daily kind of greetings in the morning where everyone comes in, we do a big group game or activity, song, and then we go about our work cycle. Then hopefully we'll have lunch either in one of the shelters at Sandy Beach or out on the beach, weather provided. And then the afternoons are really where it gets exciting, because that is where we're going to be going out, and we've adapted some activities from a lot of different mm-hmm. curricula from Project Learning Tree and from Project Wild and various existing environmental ed curricula that are out there, and kind of tried to make them more appropriate for this age and more Montessori, so more freedom of choice for the child, more things.
And you were just saying that each 2-week session, right, is going to end with a field trip
of
some kind?
Yeah, so the Monday through Thursday will be very kind of in the Douglas area, and then the Fridays are going to be for field trips. So the first Friday will probably be a smaller field trip, and the second Friday is kind of the idea is this is a big culminating event of the whole camp. So right now we're talking to people for Alpine. We might try to do the tram. We've had a lead on doing NOAA possibly for Beach Week, but that's still tentative.
Right, but
it's a really exciting kind of
okay. If somebody
thing.
Wants more information, where should they go?
So they should definitely call the main number of Juno Montessori School, which is 364-3535. And you, all your questions can be answered, and you can get registration materials that way, and we've got brochures and stuff like that. We're currently in the middle of redesigning our website, which may or may not be up right now, so I'm kind of hesitant to give out that email, that that URL, but 364-3535, yeah, and, I mean, we're definitely signing people up, and, you know, spaces are going, we've got room, but, you know, they are kind of filling up, and it's, you know, it's really going to be great. I think hopefully we can grow this program and have it every summer. That would be really great. I think a lot of people in town are starting to identify what are some needs as far as child, not care, but, you know, activities for kids to do, varieties of things. And, you know, even at that, there was a whole symposium of summer programs for the first time this summer, and there's all kinds of great stuff, and this is just, you know, one other really great thing, but specifically for children who normally may kind of be along for their older brother's ride or sister's ride. They can do something here for themselves that's very, very independent.
Paige, it looks like you have something else you want to share?
Also, there's a few of some posters around. I know there's some on the wall in the pool, and you can see about the camps. I know the first session at the beach, they're going to be looking at life in the interior zones and ocean, and they're going to look for life cycles and marine animals and stuff.
That sounds great. Remind me when that starts.
That is very soon.
June 6th.
Okay.
Yep. And also, Wednesday night, I have the Douglas Library Conference Room reserved at 5 p.m. Just to kind of do an info session. I'll have a presentation at 5 just about kind of the philosophy of the camp, what a day might look like for any parents who are interested in that. And then we'll just also kind of touch on why being outdoors is important for child development. It's a big thing. And Montessori was one of the first people to really recognize that and say, you know, children need nature in order to develop fully.
When and where is this info session again?
So it is Wednesday at 5 p.m. at the Douglas Library Meeting Room.
Okay. I think we just about got it. Anything else any of you would like to add?
No. I mean,
all right.
Thanks very much. You're really helpful.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah, thank you
Jeff
for having
Hirsch,
us.
Paige, and Elise Sorenberg, they're here talking about a K-1 summer program. For more information, call the Juno Montessori over there in Douglas at 364-3535.
To the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise. If you go down to the woods today, you better go in disguise. For every bear that ever there was will gather there for certain, because today's the day. The teddy bears have their picnic. Every teddy bear who's been good is sure of a treat today. There's lots of marvelous things to eat and wonderful games to play. Beneath the trees where nobody sees, they'll hide and seek as long as they please, 'cause that's the way the teddy bears have their picnic. Picnic time for teddy bears. The little teddy bears are having a lovely time today. Watch them, catch them unawares, and see them picnic on their holiday. about. They love to play and shout, they never have any cares. At 6 o'clock, their mommies and daddies will take them home to bed because they're tired little teddy bears. To stay at home, for every bear that ever there was will gather there together, because today's the day the teddy bears have their pick. Today's the day the teddy bears have their picnic.
This station comes from the Augustus Brown Swimming Pool, located at 1619 Glacier Avenue in downtown Juneau, offering aqua aerobics on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays from 11 a.m. until 12 p.m., and stretch aquatics on Tuesdays and Thursdays from 11 a.m. until 11:45 a.m. Schedules are available online at juneau.org/park/pool. More information at 586-5325.
You're listening to a Juno Afternoon here on Monday, May 23rd, 2016. Scott Burton, your host, and joining me in the studio now here on a Juno Afternoon is Patricia Kalbrenner. She is our development account manager here at K2, which we're very thankful for. But you're wearing kind of a different hat today, Patricia. You're here to talk about the Juno Film Office. Why don't you tell us a little bit about it?
So the Juno Film Office was something that we got started. It's kind of had a quiet, slow evolution because it was born from the idea that all of a sudden we had the Alaska State Film Credit, and all of these companies were coming into town to film their reality shows and to do their photo shoots and all of these things. And there wasn't really any infrastructure for that here in Juneau.
And back up a little. What was the film credit, the Alaska State Film Credit?
So it was basically a tax credit that companies who spent over a certain amount on their production in Alaska would receive in return. And a lot of states have this, and it's sort of a way to attract these companies to come to their state to shoot. And it was working. And then as soon as they yoinked it, there were a lot of productions that decided they didn't want to shoot here anymore, and that flow really slowed down. So the Juno Film Office, which was created with the idea that, hey, we don't have to hire a company from Anchorage to come down to Juno to help you guys shoot here, because what would inevitably end up happening is Juno people would end up, you know, fielding the production anyway, because they know Juno and Anchorage people didn't know Juno. So we were like, we should have a film office here. And they should be hiring here, and they should be doing everything locally, and that will keep the money local, and it will keep people here trained and learning new things, and all the filmmakers in Juneau would have just basically more of an opportunity to educate themselves and actually get real live work experience. So once the film credit was no longer active, it was like, okay, well, got the ball rolling on this Juno Film Office. What does it become now? And so what it looks like it's starting to evolve into is more of a collaborative platform for local filmmakers in Juneau and hopefully someday Southeast Alaska to kind of find each other and connect. Because if you do want to make narrative films or documentary films or whatever kind of project you're working on, it takes so many perspectives and hands on deck and different kind of, like, people from different artistic backgrounds. And so collaboration is key to filmmaking. And so hopefully the Juno Film Office can help foster that.
And you have a meeting coming up this Wednesday at 6 o'clock if people want to learn more, right?
Yes, we do. So what we're trying to do is have a meeting every second and fourth Wednesday of every month. And the idea of the meetings, the structure that we're hoping to accomplish is start every meeting with, like, a brief workshop, something to do with filmmaking, so that we can have a little bit of a learning experience, and then follow that up with some discussion on what people need, what kind of projects are going on, what people think the Juno Film Office can do to serve them better in the future. And then, so on this Wednesday, this upcoming Wednesday, David Purdy is going to do a lighting for film workshop, which I've already seen him do a brief version of this, and it was excellent, so I'm looking forward to that.
He knows the stuff.
He does. And this is also a good opportunity for photographers as well. He does an overview of the three-point lighting, and it's a good brush-up for people who haven't had this in a while and for people that are just curious about lighting in general. It's a good way to kick off the meeting. And that will start at 6 o'clock at the Jack Gallery this Wednesday. And then afterwards, we have a special treat that I'm hoping will become more frequent. So Greg Chaney has a romantic comedy script that he's hoping to film this summer, and he would like to do a table read. So at 7:30, after the meeting is over, if people want to stick around to do that, that should be a really fun kind of add-on to this event. And what I'm hoping, and, like, well, I think it would be really neat if the Juno Film Office could provide a space for other people to do table reads as well. And, you know, just sort of, I'm really hoping that what it becomes in the future is something that fits what everybody needs to progress in their craft.
Sure. And tell us a little bit about yourself, your background in filmmaking and videography, and what inspired you to get involved with this.
I love storytelling, so I'm a big fan of fiction when it comes to filmmaking, although I am working on a roller derby documentary right now, and, you know, I've dabbled a little bit in wedding videos and such. I went to school at the University of Las Vegas learn about filmmaking, and one of my professors gave me the advice that I should instead just try to get myself onto some sets and get some real world experience. I was lucky enough in Hawaii to find myself on the set of Forgetting Sarah Marshall, which led to being on the set of Lost as a production assistant, and that was a really big eye-opener because it made me realize, like, what a huge, gigantic, creative realm filmmaking it is. Like, just to see it all in action was really incredible. And then what was really cool was coming back to Juno, and all of a sudden, like, it's the most popular place on the planet to do a reality show, and everybody's coming through, and there's just all these production experiences left and right. And it was so I've had actually more experience being in Juno now on set than I had outside of Juno. And, you know, I know a lot of people move to L.A., but I really, really like it here, and I want to stay. And that's part of the reason that I'm trying to bring this Juno Film Office to life, is because I would love to see more film creation economy here. And, like, I just don't want to leave. And the production value in this state is off the charts. I don't, you know, I think that we can create whatever we want right here. So, yeah, we'll see where this goes in the future.
So people can get involved this Wednesday night at 6 at the Juno Arts and Culture Center Gallery. Otherwise, where can people find you online?
Right now, what I recommend is the Southeast Alaska Filmmakers Group on Facebook, and that's where we're posting our notices for these meetings twice a month, and it will also let you know a little bit of information about what the meeting, like what kind of a workshop we're going to be having in each meeting, and any special events that we might be adding on to the meetings, like this upcoming Wednesday, reading, doing the table read for Greg's script, et cetera.
And what kind of person do you think would fit in best? Is this for intermediate filmmakers, beginners, advanced?
I think this is for everyone. And a big reason, like the first thing that pops into my head is when you're on a film set, you have everyone. You have people that are just starting out. You have people that are like long-time experienced filmmakers in whatever their medium and their craft is. You have people that are visual artists. You have people that are like logistically minded and know how to make a production run smoothly. I would really hope that in the future at some point we can get more youth involved so that they can grow with this, because I did some work recently with the Montessori school, and those kids were so creative. It was so exciting and refreshing, and I feel like there's, all-inclusive.
Okay. Patricia Kalbrenner, she is part of the Juno Film Office. They meet this Wednesday at 6 o'clock at the Jack Gallery. Anything we're missing? Anything you want to add, Patricia?
6 to 7:30 at the Jack Gallery, and the table read will begin at 7:30 for people who want to stay for that. If people do have any questions, feel free. I'm one of the moderators on the Southeast Alaska Film Group. Just shoot us a message. If you have any ideas for workshops that you'd like to produce, or for if you want to become more established, like if you want to really help out with this Juno Film Office, we're going to be kind of trying to establish more of an infrastructure over the next year. So people that really want to get involved, now is a great time.
All right. Thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Thank you, Scott.
Bird Note. As a tree swallow swoops gracefully across a marsh, its long, slender wings glint a deep iridescent blue. It glides close to the surface, tips its head down, and lightly skims the pond for a second with its beak open, drinking on the wing. Many birds drink while standing, dipping their beaks into a pond or birdbath, taking a beakful, and then tossing their heads back to swallow the water. And most birds can't pull off a daredevil in-flight drink because they just aren't built for it. Swallows are such virtuosos of flight that their skimming the pond almost looks like showing off. Drinking on the wing suits swallows best. They walk awkwardly on the ground on rather short legs, and their long wings are pretty cumbersome. So it's far more efficient to grab a drink on the glide. This adaptation holds true for some other birds, too. Common nighthawks are much bigger than swallows, with a 2-foot wingspan. They take their water in flight, too, while swifts, with an even longer winged structure than swallows, have such short legs that they never land on the ground. And so a sip on the wing is all but essential. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon here on Monday, May 23rd, 2016. It's about 24 minutes until the top of the hour. And joining me in the studio now is a storyteller, writer, photographer, musician, probably missing a few other things, Kim Hecox. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Did I miss anything on your description?
No, I'm fine with that.
Okay.
maybe a little too long, but whatever. Thank you.
You're welcome. Nice to have you on the show. Last time I saw you, we got to speak about Jimmy Blue Feather, your newest novel.
Last fall,
I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How is that going?
Well, it's getting good reviews, and it's getting great reviews, actually. And I can't quite believe it. It won the National Outdoor Book Award. It's the first time a novel has ever won that award.
Wow.
So, yeah, it's exciting. I'm honored. I really am.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
I suspect you can find that anywhere at any of our bookstores here in Juneau.
I hope so.
Right. Okay. And in front of you is something that's very exciting, and I'm going to let you describe it for our listening audience.
Right. It's a National Geographic book, and it's a $50 large format exhibit book, 370 pages, called The National Parks, An Illustrated History, 100 Years of American Splendor.
Wow.
Yep. There you go.
I mean, that's a big book.
That's a big book. Yeah, I bench press it in the morning to stay in shape. Yeah, it's a celebration of the... This is the 100th anniversary year of the U.S. National Park Service, which was established on August 25th, 1916.
And so National Geographic came to you and asked you to go. And did you do the photography and the writing, or?
No, the photography was recruited from existing photos out there in the world. And you'll notice that many of the photographs are historical. So if we're talking about, let's say, Katmai National Monument being established in 1918 or Glacier Bay National Monument in 1925, they went out and found photos of those places in the 19-teens or the 1920s. So lots of historical images, as well as really beautiful, compelling modern images, too.
Okay. And so you collaborated with those images, in a sense, and created this prose, these descriptions. And you have one there. Would you mind sharing it with us?
A reading?
Yeah.
Right. In order to write this book, I had to make it both compelling, so that means storytelling, about the creation of certain parks, or what national parks mean to the people of the world, because the idea has spread all over the world. And then it needs to be comprehensive as well, because there's 411 National Park Service units. So I would tell stories, and then in a final paragraph I would wrap in all the other units that came into the Park Service during that time, the 1930s or the 1960s, and what was happening with Congress and America at the time. You know, were we at war? Was Congress beneficial to the, looking favorably upon public lands then? And that was exciting. It was a big history lesson for me. So let me just read to you a couple short stories and then a wrap-up paragraph. One morning in 2004, a bus stopped near the new World War II Memorial on the National Mall. Dedicated to the greatest generation, 16 million Americans who served in the U.S. military from 1941 to 1945. As a group of white-haired old men got out of the bus, many walking slowly, a few with canes, a passing jogger stopped and asked them if they were World War II veterans. Yes, they said. Not many World War II veterans remained. More than 1,000 were dying each day. Soon they'd all be gone. The jogger hugged them one by one and told them her grandfather had been liberated by American soldiers from a German concentration camp. They all ended up in tears. Thank you, she told them. You made the world a better place. Thank you for your service and your sacrifice. And another story. Daniel Chur, a Park Service paleontologist at Dinosaur National Monument, that's in Utah, loves to share his passion for fossils with visitors, especially children from the Make-A-Wish Foundation. He once asked an ailing boy, Nathan, to name his favorite dinosaur. Nathan told him it was Compsognathus, which was known from only two specimens. He knew everything about it, Chur said, how rare it was, how small it was, what it ate, where it lived. He could talk about it like a pro. When it came time to say goodbye, Chur handed Nathan his own prized cast of the dinosaur and said, I've had this cast for several years and have enjoyed it, but you're the Compsognathus guy, and it should really be yours. The look in Nathan's eyes, Daniel said, was unforgettable. The unforgettable happens every day in America's national parks and other preserved sites. Every day brings revelations and affirmations, moments of great joy and simple truths. National parks don't require us to reinvent ourselves. They simply give us a window and a mirror in which to see ourselves, who we are, once were, and can be. They give us a canvas upon which to paint our imagination. They give us stories and deep time, history and great sacrifice. They give us hope. They can be life-changing, even life-saving, and always their life-affirming.
Okay. Where did you find these stories? Where was the inspiration for this?
Okay, this is the centennial year of the National Park Service, so there are many programs going on this year, celebration programs. Find Your Park, based on the notion that the most important nature is the nature that's nearby, right? Find that Park Service unit closest to your home and go there. Every kid in the park, President Obama made the parks free admission to any fourth grader and his or her family all year long, just to get kids involved with nature. And another program is Share Your Story, and that was put together by Jonathan Jarvis, the director of the Park Service, inviting any employee of the National Park Service to send in to the Share Your Story website a story, a profound moment for you as an employee with the Park Service. And so I mined that.
Okay.
It's great.
Yeah.
There's hundreds of them. So anybody can go there, Share Your Story, and the public can go there and National Park Service, Share Your Story, and you'll find it.
I mean, this is a big work. It almost seems like it would have been overwhelming. Was it?
It was, and I was in the thick of other books. As if you remember, Scott, I had four books come out in 2014, 2015. And so I said to the National Geographic, I said, I can't do this. I can't. And Melanie, my wife, a National Park Service employee, said, Kim, think about it. Let's think about this, and maybe there's a way to do this. Because it was a tight deadline. They wanted it out in 10 months, writing all the text and all the captions to all the photos.
Wow. What's been the most fulfilling part of this project for you?
Learning. Everything I learned about the Clara Barton National Historic Site, about Rosie the Riveter, World War II, women working in the World War II effort in near Oakland, California, which Richmond, California, learning about Trail of Tears, Nez Perce National Historic Site, the 16 small little units that comprise Chief Joseph's attempt to reach in, I believe, 1877 to escape the U.S. Army. And a phenomenal places I learned. It was learning so much.
And our listeners can learn along with you. This book is probably also going to be available widely.
Right. I was just on the Hearthside Book Cruise on Saturday night out of Ock Bay up toward beyond Shelter Island and Benjamin Island, and I think I signed like 6 or 8 of them, and Hearthside has many more copies.
Okay.
It's a great gift book.
Right. How many photos would you guesstimate are in there? I mean, how many pages is that?
It's 368 pages, I believe, and I would estimate that there's probably about 300 photographs, many
wow.
of them double page.
Well, Kim, thank you so much for coming in and sharing with us your Jimmy Bluefeather and this new National Geographic National Park celebration. What a project. Anything else you want to tell us about?
Right. One last thing. Thanks for having me, Scott. August 25th is a centennial date. And if you're not aware, there's a new tribal house, Huna Tlingit Tribal House, being built in Bartlett Cove, Glacier Bay National Park, that will be unveiled, big opening ceremony, on August 25th of this year. It's a 20-year culmination of a memorandum of understanding signed between the Huna Tlingit and the National Park Service. And canoes are being carved at this moment, completed, and Huna Tlingit, I believe, in full regalia, are going to paddle those canoes into Bartlett Cove, across Icy Strait, into Bartlett Cove on that day or just before, and it's going to be a profound event.
And members of the public will be able to attend and view that?
Yes, I believe so. I hope I'm not speaking out of line. I think hundreds of people are already expected.
Okay.
Elders from, I mean, I think Juneau, Sitka, Haines, Huna, certainly, Angoon, Cake, Sitka. I don't know. I just, oh my goodness. It's going to be tremendous. And, you know, the National Park Service is... has had a shortcoming in addressing the plight of Native Americans throughout its history. They could have done better. And here, I believe, Glacier Bay is really hitting the ball out of the park. There's an emissary working in the Park Service. There's a facilitator working in Huna. Their work, it's, and I've seen the tribal house from outside. Only nobody's been able to walk into it yet. And it's so beautiful. It just brings tears to your eyes. So I can just imagine the elders, you know, it's going to be so profound.
And this will be August 25th, you said?
August 25th, I believe. You can check in with the U.S. National Park Service, maybe the Huna Indian Association,
Okay. Well, great. And maybe come back, or we should definitely have members of the Huna Tlingit come and tell us about more. About that, I'm sure our listeners would love.
Maybe during celebration.
Absolutely.
Here in early June.
Call
Huna and find out. Absolutely.
All right. Kim Hecox, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you. here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 23rd of May, 2016. It is World Turtle Day, celebrating the creature who first appears in fossils of the Triassic period 220 million years ago. They live long. Their cells don't age like ours do. The largest turtle, the leatherback sea turtle, up to 2,000 pounds, 6.5 feet long. It's the birthday of the poet Jane Kenyon, Ann Arbor, Michigan, 1947. Father was a jazz musician, taught piano, her mother a nightclub singer who taught sewing. Jane Kenyon was a shy young woman, went to the University of Michigan, married her teacher, Donald Hall, 19 years older, and they moved to New Hampshire, where she wrote spare, elegiac poems about country life. Kenyon and Hall lived on their farm, got up every morning, walked the dog, made coffee, ate breakfast, went upstairs to write. She, in a room in the attic, they had lunch, they took naps, they opened the mail and wrote until dinner. He called her Stubbsy, she called him Perkins. Over time, her poetry drew a large, loyal audience. She gave readings to large crowds. She became a Congregationalist. She died in 1995 after a 15-month battle with leukemia. Jane Kenyon, who said, "Be a good steward of your gifts, protect your time, take the phone off the hook, work regular hours." It's the birthday of Edward Norton Lorenz, West Hartford, Connecticut, 1917, mathematician turned to meteorology during World War II, and in trying to explain why it's so difficult to make a long-range weather forecast, he came up with chaos theory, sometimes known as the butterfly effect, meaning that small actions in a dynamic system like the atmosphere can trigger vast and unexpected changes. He asked the question, does the flap of a butterfly's wings in Brazil set off a tornado in Texas? Science fiction writers have been playing around with the idea for years in their time travel stories. He was the one who took it seriously. And it's the birthday of Margaret Wise Brown, Brooklyn, New York, 1910. She had already published 20 children's books when one day she looked around her house, started writing a poem. In the great green room, there was a telephone and a red balloon and a picture of the cow jumping over the moon. And that resulted in Goodnight Moon, one of the best-selling children's books of all time. Here's a poem for today by Jane Kenyon, entitled At the Store. Clumps of daffodils along the storefront bend low this morning, late snow, pushing their bright heads down. The flag snaps and tugs at the pole beside the door. The old freezer, full of Maine blueberries and breaded scallops, mumbles along, a box of fresh bananas on the floor, luminous and exotic. I take what I need from the narrow aisles. Cousins arrive like themes and variations. Ansel leans on the counter, remembering other late spring snows, the blue snow of 32. Yes, it was blue. Forest comes and goes quickly with a length of stovepipe, telling about the neighbor's chimney fire. The store is a bandstand. All our voices sound from it, making the same motley American music Ives heard. This piece starting quietly with a repeated clink of a flagpole pulley in the doorway of a country store. At the Store by Jane Kenyon, from her collection Otherwise, published by Grey Wolf Press, used by permission here in the Writer's Almanac, supported by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years, and by Organic Valley, a co-op of family farmers bringing organic half-and-half to America's morning coffee since 1988. Organic Valley, bringing the good. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
If you'd like to keep up with the variety of activities, people, and events in the capital city, you want to tune into a Juno Afternoon. Find out about concerts, meetings, events, classes, and speakers that add vitality to our community. Get to know your fellow residents. Plan your schedule. Learn what's going on and how you can be involved. Or be a part of the program by being a guest and passing the word about what you're up to. A Juno Afternoon, weekdays live at 3 on KTUO News, repeated at 4 on KRNN, and available on demand via KTUO.org.
Support comes from the Alaska Robotics Gallery, offering art that features narwhals, squid, and flying whales, located at 220 Front Street in downtown Juneau. More information at alaskarobotics.com.
Thanks for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon today here on Monday, May 23rd. Tomorrow on a Juno Afternoon, Lori Scanlane will be your host, and she'll speak with Amy Skillbred from the Juno Community Foundation and Wayne Stevens from the United Way about an elementary school breakfast program. Other guests will talk about a unique teen kayak trip, and we'll also learn more about the Juno Reentry Coalition. And high school principals will talk about graduation. Those interviews, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more live at 3 on KTOO News and online via KTOO.org. Let's take a look at the weather. The forecast for tonight calls for mostly cloudy skies with scattered showers. And tomorrow, Tuesday, the forecast calls for mostly cloudy conditions with scattered showers. Again, Wednesday, same thing, mostly cloudy skies with scattered showers. Highs around 56. And Thursday, partly cloudy skies and no call of scattered showers that day. Highs around 64. Thank you for tuning in to a Juno Afternoon.